Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello there, and welcome to another episode of New Books in Asian American Studies, a podcast of the New Books Network. I'm Chris Patterson, a co-host of the network, and my guest today is Jan Patios, who is an associate professor and director of graduate studies in the American Studies Department at the University of Maryland, College Park, and an affiliate faculty in Women's Studies and the Asian American Studies program. We'll discuss her new book, A Nation on the Line, Call Centers as Postcolonial Predicaments in the Philippines, which was published by Duke University Press in March 2018. Dr. Patios' book sheds light on the industry of offshore call centers in the Philippines and attempts to understand the narratives cast upon call center workers as laborers whose main resource is their ability to relate to their Western and specifically American clientele. What does it mean when we see relatability as a national resource? How are Filipino workers reshaped by the seemingly benevolent industry? Dr. Patios attempts to tackle these questions through years of transnational research involving interviews and participation, and through understanding call center work within a larger context of American colonization and neoliberal policies that have shaped the contemporary Philippines. So here to tell us more about her book, let's welcome Jan Patios to the podcast. Jan, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Chris. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. Can you begin by telling us a bit more about yourself and what brought you to write this book?
Sure. So how I came to this project is that, you know, a couple of, actually many years ago now, this really interesting thing happened in my family. And I talk about this in the beginning of the book. You know, so for decades, one of my aunts here in the United States, she's a retired nurse. She was sending remittances home and these remittances home to the Philippines. And these remittances were paying for some of my younger cousins to go to school and to study nursing with the expectation that they would become nurses, take the board exam, and then come to the United States or go to the UK to work abroad and then kind of start that whole process over again. So for reasons, though, that are still not too clear to me, one of my cousins who was supported in this manner by our aunt, she didn't want to continue in the, you know, down the nursing trajectory. She had gone to nursing school, but at the point at which she was about to take the board exam, she disappeared. She disappeared for about 2 weeks. And, you know, of course, everybody in our family was worried about her, was concerned, you know, didn't know if she was okay, didn't know where she was. But 2 weeks later, she actually resurfaced and she said she was fine. And she let everybody know that she had gotten a job in a call center. And, you know, my aunt was very angry about this and everyone was really surprised. And, partly it was the anger was about a sense of kind of betrayal and false promise. But also I think there was a lot of worry that working in a call center was not, a wise idea. So, everything was fine. That my cousin's fine today. But at the time I became really curious about this place that she wanted to work and why she wanted to work there. And, she told us that the money was good. She was supporting herself. She had made friends. She liked working there. And so I became very curious about what call centers were and why so many young people, not just my cousin, were going to work there. So all of this happened at an interesting time during my graduate studies at NYU. I was a second year doctoral student in American Studies, and I was in the Philippines doing archival research on American businesses in the Philippines during the colonial era. At the time, I really was very interested in understanding how the intensification of capitalist market relations in general and the increasing presence of American companies and products in particular had changed Filipino lives in the first few decades of the 20th century. I was really interested, you know, in consumer culture, markets, kind of, political economy, things like that. And for me, that was a way of studying how colonialism as power worked through everyday life and culture, which is, you know, a foundational idea in the field of American studies. So that's what I was doing in the archive. But, you know, as I just described, all of these things were happening outside of the archive in my family. And, you know, I was in the Philippines seeing lots of people going to work in call centers. And it kind of dawned on me that these questions that I was asking in the archive were questions that I could really easily apply to about the present, right, when the dynamics right there in front of me. So I started to shift my attention toward call centers and think about how to do an ethnographic project. I had done ethnography for my master's degree, so that really wasn't new to me, and it was a method that I enjoyed. So really, I came to the call center by accident, or a combination, I would say, of accident, intention, and intense curiosity. At the time, I wasn't somebody who had studied work culture or labor processes, but that changed really quickly.
Your book usefully unpacks not only how call center labor grows out of imperial relationships with the U.S., but also can be seen as a sign of how these imperial relationships have changed. Can you unpack this for us? How do we see call center work in relation to American empire and capital?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Chris, and it's really like at the the heart of the book and why I wanted to write it. I would say that the continuity between colonialism, American colonialism, and call centers is, I think, fairly clear from the surface of things, right? So the call center industry is a place that demands that people speak English serve an audience of customers from advanced industrialized countries, right? And English is the language that Americans insisted that Filipinos learn during the colonial era. And, for that reason, a large majority of the, population speaks English. It's also, the industry is also built on this idea of an assumed cultural proximity between Americans and Filipinos. So this idea that Filipinos are kind of very intimately knowledgeable about America, American ways of life, and therefore uniquely suited to do call center work or customer service work. And then really there's the kind of larger dynamics of labor exploitation that have been that structure the global economy. And so outsourcing to the Philippines is part of a really long history of Filipino labor being incorporated into the U.S. economy and being exploited by U.S. capital. And so I do frame it that way, in the beginning of the book, it's really important to understand the call center as not unique in that sense, as being part of that longer history. And then there's also the larger structure of outsourcing from the U.S. and other wealthy countries. So, the outsourcing of customer service jobs from the United States began actually as early as the late 1970s, but it was really in the 1990s that it took off with, massive corporate downsizing and shareholder revolution and things like that. The work started to go abroad, first to locations in the UK, and then, of course, India became a very huge location. And then from India, the work started to also be sent to countries in Southeast Asia and other locations in the world. And that's when really the Philippines kind of came on the scene. So, those are kind of the surface things that I think will be apparent to, folks who know some things about these different dynamics. But once I really scratched the surface of this in my research, I saw some nuances to how this kind of imperial relations worked in the present. And as you said, this is about how power is operating now, and it isn't that, it's that the power is operating in a new way under neoliberal globalization. So there's an emphasis in the industry really on market relationships and partnership and investment, all of these sort of seemingly neutral terms that have to do with capital and that have to do with the global economy. But what I look at is the way that those terms really mask the ongoing imperial relations and the great deal of unevenness in the ways that the labor and value are flowing between the Philippines and the United States. So some examples of this from the fieldwork are that, the English language, for example, is something that, of course, is highly valued within the industry. And but it's interesting, it's interesting for me to find that people really value the language, not because it has this proximity to a former colonial power, but because they see it as the language of global capital. And so there's a way in which that there's a shift to a kind of calling out of, not calling out of, but a kind of recognition of like power dynamics to a kind of dismissal of those dynamics, or a way in which those dynamics are played down because it's understood that it's like in everybody's interest, so to speak, to speak English. There's also this sense, especially in 2008 and 2009, when I really started doing this field work, that the U.S. was a an economy and a country in decline, and so that when call centers, when corporate clients came to the Philippines to find Filipino labor and to employ Filipino labor, what the Philippines was doing was helping those corporations rather than being supplicant to them. So this language of partnership kind of came in to replace the language of domination or submission. And you can really see these dynamics at like a very minute level in the industry as well. One of the things that labor scholars have talked about for a very long time is the way that labor processes, especially when you add technology to them, they get broken down into smaller and smaller, units of labor. And that's what kind of, degrades the labor and makes it, possible for people to be paid very low wages for simple parts of a process. And this happens in the call center industry as well. So that, so there are some individuals who are working in call centers who only really like are trained to do very particular things with a very particular type of technology. So on the account that I was trained to work on, which we'll talk about more in a few minutes, I'm sure, is, one of the things that we learned was just very specifically how to deal with a very specific type of printer for a very specific type of customer. And on the one hand, a kind of labor scholar would see this and say this is part of that breakdown of the labor process into smaller and smaller tasks that don't require as much skill. But within the call center industry, this kind of knowledge is recast as subject matter expertise. So that it gets given a name, it's given a legitimacy, and it is meant to definitely kind of elevate that knowledge that somebody has. But it's also a way, in my opinion, to recast that knowledge as something that is, again, sort of neutral or to some extent positive. And I kind of look at some of those deep dynamics in the fieldwork. So it was really fascinating, but really vexing to see how market logic and thinking permeate so much, of the way that people think about these relationships in the present. And, and I really want to argue, I really do argue that this is really not the best way to think about social relations, right, between people. So that's a really big reason that the book itself is a critique of these global relations and is, a larger critique of capitalism.
Yeah, and I think now that you said all that, I start to get why I was so enticed by that anecdote that you gave before. In the sense that I'm thinking of like Iowa Ong's first book about microprocessor factories in Malaysia, and how they were kind of delivered with a very similar promise, right? That because these factories are associated with information technology or new technology and knowledge economies, that this is always a progressive step forward, you know, compared to those other types of service work. And I think the way you describe it in your book is quite similar in that it has this kind of this aura of like information technology, and that we're kind of, that this is a kind of entry point right into that global economy. But what was interesting, I think, because this is an ethnographic project, that we kind of got to see the nitty and gritty of the type of skill sets that were really demanded upon these workers, and just how difficult, first of all, the work was, how demanding it was, but how demanding it was almost more on one's emotions and one's abilities to like multitask, and control every situation and be able to like calculate, you know, how much time they're spending talking to the customer. And of course, to take a lot of crap, right, from the customers, depending on how, you know, whose fault it is and everything like that. And so, those were some of those really fascinating points for me, was being able to kind of enter into those spaces and then realize that this is the narrative associated with them is so different than what it actually feels like, I think, to be there. So can you talk a bit about the experience of being there, you know, your researches and methods, how you conducted research, who you talked to, and any difficulties you might have faced?
Sure. So, you know, this is... So it's an ethnographic project, but I should say that, you know, I'm an interdisciplinary scholar, and the field of American studies is an interdisciplinary field. And actually, I, even as an undergraduate, I didn't study in or major in, you know, in a discipline. So I'm used to using multiple qualitative methods to do research, and I really enjoy that. But yes, the core of the book is ethnographic. So I do try to provide readers with a lot of that, that, you know, nitty gritty, kind of thick everyday description. And so it's interesting to talk about the book because, you know, I have both the big ideas that I'm trying to get across to the book, but then, you know, there's lots of little, you know, stories and, you know, points about particular people that kind of, you know, I hope come out in the work. And it's a challenge, speaking of challenges, to kind of go from that sort of everyday examination to these larger ideas. And that's one of the things I hope people, you know, take away from the book, is that kind of method and that analysis, or methodology and analysis. So, ethnography, you know, it's a method in which a researcher derives knowledge, you know, through an engagement, or develops knowledge through an engagement with people and places in real time, in the here and now. And it's a method that's extremely useful for understanding how people make sense of the social and cultural worlds in which they live and how they create those worlds day in and day out. And so the people that I interviewed and observed and got to know for this book included, for the most part, a lot of call center workers. So people who were taking calls day in and day out, or mostly nightly, to be more accurate. Those are sort of, sometimes they're called rank and file workers. So these are call center agents, and some of their team leaders who were lower level managers. I also interviewed and observed upper level managers, as well as industry leaders. So these are sort of people who work in the industry, but not in a call center. They work to support the industry overall and market the Philippines to corporations around the world. And there were also some activists and government officials that I interviewed. And majority of the people that I interviewed were Filipino people, although there was one, there were Americans, white Americans that I also became part of the research that we can, you know, obviously talk about a little bit later. And the places that I went were, I did a lot of observation in call centers themselves, in Bacolod City, and which is where my family is from, and in Manila. And I also interviewed workers and got to know them outside of work. So, you know, in their homes, hanging out in shopping malls, going to movies, going to cafes, going on vacation with people. And, you know, through that method, really got to see multiple aspects of their lives. I would say that, like, one of the most important parts of the of the ethnographic research was a time that I spent in a call center where I trained for and applied for and trained for a job in a call center. And I know we'll probably talk a little bit more about this later, but I just want to say that that part of the research, even though it kind of represents just a small part of, you know, it only took a few weeks to kind of go through that training, it really was a very eye-opening experience and I think got me to see a lot of things that I wouldn't otherwise be able to. Some of the challenges or difficulties that I faced, I would say, you know, I talk a little bit in the beginning of the book about how security concerns changed over the time that I did the research. So when I started in 2008, I don't know if it was me or if it was the people that I, you know, the people that I interacted with, but it was actually fairly easy for me to get into a call center and to do the research I was doing. But when I went back to do follow-up observation at the same call center in 2013, I ran into some really severe obstacles. And it wasn't anything I had done in that time, you know, in between, but the company for many reasons was being much more careful about who they were letting in. And so, you know, those kinds of security concerns are a real part of the research, meaning they really inform also my understanding of the call center industry as you know, an industry that is actually incredibly secretive. You often don't see signs announcing the names of the call center, or you certainly don't know from at first sight what companies might be using a call center in the Philippines to you know, to service their clients. So the security concerns were really you know, presented certain obstacles. But one thing that listeners might be interested to know is that when I had to train for a call center job, I had to stay up all night because, you know, the jobs themselves take place pretty much overnight. And so to acclimate workers to that schedule, they start doing the training on that schedule as well. So my day really started at 10 o'clock at night and ended around 6 or 7 in the morning. And I really hated it. And it really gave me a really clear idea of what kinds of you know, the real kind of difficulty of staying up at night and how that really messes up your body. I would get dizzy spells. I would just be completely exhausted. You know, when you're staying up all night and you have to sleep during the day, you never really sleep as well as you would if you did at night. And it kind of affected my research, you know, because I wasn't that motivated at the end of a night at like 6 or 7 in the morning to kind of stay and hang out with people, which would have, you know, I think would be, it was good to do. But I really had to kind of admit to myself that that was a really hard thing for me to do. And I was mostly just wanting to go home at the end of every night. And so, you know, ethnography is interesting like that because, other methods of research certainly have their own physical challenges. It's hard to sit in an archive and look at stuff all day. But ethnography, I think more so than say like textual analysis or archival research really grafts onto your own life, you know, and hews very closely to your own life. It is your life that you were living as you were doing the research. So I really, you know, found it really difficult to pull those all-nighters while I was, you know, doing research during the training.
Well, since you mentioned your training, because this is such a powerful part of the book, and I think this is chapter 3, right, where you really talk more intimately about it. One of the things that struck me was that was the kind of cultural competency training, right, the things that actually happened in those training groups. And of course, you having this unique perspective and being like the American presence, the American like trainee presence in the room was quite interesting. And I think this will lead usefully also into some of the ideas, like one of the main ideas in your book, which is the Filipino-American relatability, right? Mm-hmm. Which you call affective capacity for the worker to relate to their American clients. And of course, this is like, again, links goes back to other types of like service work. But here's one that's much more explicit, right? In the way that it's like you are being culturally trained to be competent in to talk to Americans in a relatable way, right? And that this becomes a kind of cultural capital or resource. So can you talk maybe a bit about that a training experience and how that that brings us to that concept of Filipino-American relatability?
So absolutely. Let me start with just talking a little bit about the experience I had applying and training for a job in a call center. So like I said, you know, it was probably one of the most eye-opening aspects of the research that I did. And I learned a lot just applying for the job itself. There's actually a blood test that I had to take. It was a complete surprise that this happened in an application process in the Philippines. That's obviously something I'd not experienced in the United States. But yeah, I mean, the application process kind of mimicked the job itself. And in many ways, it was kind of modeling for applicants what the job would be like in and out. At least it's kind of in its affective register. So it was very intense. And applicants were subjected to a series of aptitude tests, essentially, that tested things from, you know, their English language capability to sort of technological know-how. And those who didn't make the cut were not allowed to move on. And by the end of the day, many of the people that I had walked in with were no longer there. And so it gave me a sense of how kind of competitive the environment would be and how fast paced. I moved on to, from there, after getting a job, I moved on to what you were referring to earlier, which is the cultural competency training. So almost every call center worker who's going to work with Americans at all is going to, you know, do a kind of cultural competency training. And it can usually, my training ran for about 1 week. And there were, you know, things in that training that you might, you know, expect. It was sort of thinking, you know, having people practice neutralizing their accents. So, not shortening vowels and kind of elongating them the way that, American English sounds. Learning how to say an unaspirated T. So when you say Manhattan, right, we say Manhattan and not Manhattan. So there were things that had to do with accent and idioms, American idioms as well. And, one of the things that I really learned in that experience was the way that cultural competency was really very specifically geared toward a customer service, relationships. So a lot of that, what people learned was how to treat the customer in such a way that the customer would feel, good essentially about the interaction and feel that they were getting the service that they, that they deserve. So a lot of this was, it's a mix of kind of general cultural information, like information about U.S. holidays and and sports teams, mixed with a lot of kind of corporate demand for a certain type of behavior on the part of an agent. And then from there, I moved on to doing the product training. And so the company that I worked for, or that I was hired, to work for, I didn't actually end up taking any calls for them. That is called Vox Elite, or I call it Vox Elite. And Vox Elite is, a major call center that has, offices all over the world. And one of their big clients was a US-based computer company that I call Elfin. And so when I was hired, I was hired onto this particular account, and the job was going to be to service these particular printers for Elfin, which is the corporate client. And so we had to have trainers from Elfin come to the Philippines and train us on how to troubleshoot those particular products. And those trainers were pretty much, the exception of one person, young white men. And so there were, interesting moments of Filipino and American relatability or non-relatability, as the case may be, in those situations.
I think that leads to one of your book's main arguments. You talk about how you and others were trained in a sense to, in this kind of service work. And this term that you use also spoke a lot to me, in the sense that I was a service worker for like 8 years, working in a movie theater, and in like sales and in big department store. And so it was like, on one hand, it spoke to me in a very interesting way, but it also speaks a lot to American empire, right? This, and you call this term Filipino slash American relatability, right? That this has become seen as a kind of cultural capital, as a national resource, but it also rehearses this kind of colonial mentality, right? Because the worker is always meant to be relatable to the clients. And this is one thing that always bugged me as a service worker, right? That the clients are in no way expected to be relatable to you. So this relatability is always going one way, one direction, right? Which you identify as a kind of labor. So can you talk a bit more about this term, Filipino-American relatability, and how how you saw that functioning in the call center?
Sure. So Filipino-American relatability is my attempt to name something that I had been thinking about for a really long time and kept showing up in my fieldwork. And it's this idea that Filipinos relate to Americans very well and very easily as a result of decades of colonization by the U.S., you know, a long history of Filipinos migrating to the United States and the kind of general presence of American culture in the country. And Filipino-American relatability, this concept, is actually a selling point within the industry. So over and over again, I heard that what makes Filipinos really ideal for servicing clients or customers in the United States is that they have this cultural proximity to Americans, that they can relate to American culture. And, you know, of course, Filipino-American relatability is a cultural and social construct. It essentializes Filipino identity and makes it something, that it's a comparative advantage in a competitive labor market. It's sort of part of that branding I was talking about earlier. But I didn't really want to just stop there in thinking about it. Constructs are created, but they also have meaning and impact. And I wanted to understand the meaning of this relatability and the impact that it was having on people and the way they think about Filipino identity. And, you know, from the start, it was really clear to me that there was a continuity with colonialism, that part of the affective architecture of colonialism, or what colonial relationships are built on, is this, really essential demand that Filipinos identify with American ways of life, ideologies, systems of government, education, and that relation or that capacity to relate was about both identifying, with America, but also being able to communicate, within the empire and communicate within English. And so I wanted to try to understand how that relatability was being, resurfaced, reshaped within the present moment in the call center industry. And it started to become clear to me that people were treating that capacity, which has these colonial roots, as a type of cultural capital and as a type of resource, as you said, for the Philippines as a nation. And I wanted to think about, what that means and what that allows us to say and understand about the present and its relationship to the colonial past.
Yeah. And like I said before, a lot of this kind of entails, taking crap from the customers in a way, or, acting subservient to the customers, even though, as you describe, and your ethnographic research is so vividly detailed, you describe the things that are going on the screen and all the, the clocks and the time that all the workers have to constantly pay attention to. And there is a performative aspect that's being ingrained or being trained, right, into the worker. And so that the customers can almost be abusive in a way, or can, often spouts off in anger, and that the workers are kind of there to absorb that. And so one thing I liked about the ethnographic research is the language that's being employed in the call centers all the time to talk about those kind of things. You even use the word like proximity. They have to have proximity to America, or they identify with America. The language that they employed really erases, any kind of inequality or performative aspect or colonial aspect to the work, right? And so can you talk maybe a bit about that and how the kind of customer service, they're responding to the customer, plays into that?
Absolutely. I think one of the most important words in the kind of call center lexicon is the word professionalism. And when I talk to or try to talk to people about the kind of racism or xenophobia or sexism that they might experience from customers when they're doing their jobs, the response was one of a kind of detached detachment in which workers really understood that when they experienced those things, their job was to not respond and to compartmentalize any response that they, any personal, you know, response that they might have, because it simply wasn't professional to respond. And so Kiran Mirkandani, who wrote the book Phone Clones, talks about this in her book as well. Her book is on call centers in India. And, you know, she finds that a lot of the Indian workers just consider this just a part of the job. So a lot of these moments really be, instead of being kind of interpreted or internalized as moments of racism and xenophobia, they get recast as, you know, kind of obstacles that the customer will put up that you just have to kind of get over and deal with as part of the job description. And so professionalism becomes one of these terms that, you know, leads to, it's helpful in that, you know, agents do have to get through the call and they have to, you know, it's good for them too to maintain composure. But it's not helpful in that it really does foreclose a critique of why some Americans are indeed, you know, doing, speaking in these ways and what that really means or says about the power relations that are playing out even in a, you know, a simple phone call.
So let's get into the book's overall structure and architecture. So your chapters seem to follow along the shifting identities and social conceptions in the Philippines that orbit call center work, moving from how this new form of labor redefines work cultures there to the kind of post-colonial cultural politics of identity and language in the training experiences and the way that the management rehearses their own roles. And then starting to end with the changing character of the middle class and then finally to shifts in like reproductive rights and sexuality. How did you come to this overall structure of the book? Why trace these kind of these discourses in the order that you do?
Great. I'd love to talk about that. So let me first say, you know, that this is, you know, an ethnography. I call this an ethnography of call centers. But from the start, I was not interested in writing a book that was more of a conventional sociology or anthropology of labor, where you know, a researcher really focuses and drills down into the labor process and the work culture and doesn't show you workers outside of that setting. I think tons of work has been really great and really formative for my own research, but I definitely wanted to, you know, deliver a book that gave readers a sense of what of the context in which this work was happening and what it meant for workers outside of the workplace. So that was part of the motivation of having chapters that go from the workplace and the labor process out toward, you know, the kind of consumer culture that workers were participating in, and, you know, into homes and intimate relationships and looking at, you know, looking at those intimate relationships amongst workers, which is where the, you know, the book ends. One of the ways I thought about, you know, one of the things that was important to me in organizing the book is that the ideas that I presented were really coming directly from the ethnographic research itself. And meaning that I didn't want to, you know, predetermine the structure by saying, well, you know, by kind of determining it based on like how I did the research, for example. I really wanted the ideas to come out of what I was learning from people by listening to them. And what I learned from people by listening to them is that, you know, there's a lot of contradiction and tension and anxiety that people experience working in the call center industry. And so I wanted each chapter to explore a different set of those kind of contradictions. And from there, you know, it wasn't easy, but you know, it more or less kind of presented itself because the contradictions are pretty stark. So to give a couple of examples, one of the aspects of the work that's very difficult for people to deal with is that a lot of people think it's a dead end, right? So a lot of young people would tell their families, I'm going into call center work, and the family, you know, their parents would, like, you know, like my aunt did, think that that was a really unwise decision. That presented an interesting contradiction for people because they're being told that the work is a dead end, but when they enter the industry, there's a lot of hope and aspiration, and there's a sense that this is actually the future of the Philippines, right? So another contradiction then would be that, workers kind of understand the global structure of labor and global services and understand that they're considered a cheaper workforce. But at the same time, because of the consumer culture that people are engaged in and the kind of money that people are making, that they don't actually feel like cheap labor. And I know we'll probably talk about this in a little bit, but this sense that this is this tension between the job as potentially a professional avenue of work. And certainly there were a lot of people that were interested in in professionalizing the industry, but also one that was this sense that it's an industry for young people who aren't really serious, about a career in the call center industry, that they're just for fast money, or that the kinds of sexual culture, consumer culture that they're involved in is actually destructive. I'm pointing these things out to point out the kind of tensions and anxieties that people experience, in the job itself. And so every chapter of the book really looks at that, going from the workplace itself to the training that workers undergo, the kinds of consumer culture and things that, people are able to kind of purchase and their aspirations to lead a middle-class life, to thinking about how sexual politics actually interacts with the industry and how people are, finding intimate relationships with one another and kind of how that led to a stigmatization of the industry.
Yeah, and I mean, speaking of that kind of, I don't know if you'd call it a looping structure, right? But one that starts with the kind of, like you mentioned, the intimacy between the workers, and then also ends kind of with that, but in the end you talk about it more of as an excess, right? It's too intimate, right? In the way that, like, these call centers are framed as queer. So maybe we can just tackle both of those sections together, because I think that they work together in a very interesting way, right? And in the first one, you talk about how, and I love this definition, so you talk about productive intimacy, which you call, I'm just going to quote you, the form close relationships between coworkers take when made productive for capital. What I like so much about it is that you resist the idea that, like, okay, either these are new and resistant types of communities and relationships and solidarities that it's against capital, or they're just being, formed for the purposes of, like, exploitation and capitalism. And I think, like you said, so much of your work comes from the research, but it also comes from really engaging with the people, not choosing either of those options right away when talking to and communicating, and instead trying to listen a bit for how those relationships are really meaningful, and they can, take many different forms, but they're also made productive for capital, right? And so it's more of an and than a necessarily than a but, that connects those two sections, right? So maybe you can just talk a bit about productive intimacy, right? What that is, and how you saw it take place within the call centers.
Sure, yeah. I'm really glad that you mentioned listening, because when this book was my dissertation, the title was Listening Between the Lines. And you're right, when you listen to what people say about their experiences, and you talk, and they talk to you about the things that they go through day in and day out, it's really obvious that those kind of dichotomies between being completely the work being complete drudgery, or completely freeing and new, that those dichotomies just don't work, they're not very productive. So this concept of productive intimacy was my way of naming some of these kind of complex dynamics, in which a workplace can really culture can foster closeness among coworkers, and how that closeness actually can help a company get more out of workers, right? More productivity, more regulation and control, more positive identification with the corporate culture, more motivation, and of course, more value in the form of profit. But at the same time, those productively intimate relationships are experienced in many ways as real by workers, and they're finding, a kind of intimacy and a kind of support amongst one another, which they need because the work is incredibly grueling. It's incredibly demanding. It's incredibly demotivating. And so I wanted to, be able to think about and have other people think about what, how that kind of intimacy might work without collapsing it into either, a completely bad thing or, a completely good thing. Teammates who needed and wanted support from one another, they have, they developed that intimacy. And I also saw it with managers who wanted to manage their teams and really motivate their teams by kind of getting to know people. And, you're right. The concept of intimacy returns at the end of the book when I talk about the intimacies that develop between workers in call centers, and is part of the reason that the call centers had this stigmatization of being in a sexualized, overly sexualized environment. And I refer to that, as the queering of the call center industry. So it's not just about sex, but it's also about, the presence of a large population of gender non-normative individuals who are kind of in the call center expressing, new kind of gender identities and sexual identities. And the way that those intimacies are not considered productive by many people, many observers, in part because they are non-reproductive in that real, in that sense of social reproduction, right? That they're not heteronormative and they're not supported within the marriage of the institution of marriage. And so there's a way in which kind of productivity and intimacy are words that definitely circulate throughout throughout the book. And it's really I'm glad that that came through.
You kind of just answered the last question that I had for you about those last chapters. So I'm glad we were able to kind of conceptualize all that together. But we did skip a bit of the middle part, which is where you talk more about the kind of structure of the call center and the management and your experiences with the management and how they kind of rationalize their positions within a kind of racialized and gendered logic that's also very market driven, of course, or as always kind of at bottom, very market driven. So can you focus a bit on these like larger authoritative mechanisms that you talk about in the middle part of your book and the role of management and middle management?
Sure. There is a decent amount about management and managers in those middle chapters. And, one of the ways that the manager's kind of market-driven logic, one of the things that it really shows is the extent to which people, the participants in my research were really internalizing the logic and really coming to identify with the firms. And this was actually something that they understood was happening as well. I talk about an interview that I had with one person who he was in HR or human resources. So he was in charge of, doing the hiring. And he came to this point where he realized that he really liked working in the call center because people, he and his coworkers were so invested in the work and that they could, that they could kind of put all of themselves in it and that it was an environment that, that supported that. And so I think what, you see a lot of the managers, in positions that, kind of push them to internalize things. And in some ways they struggle with that as well. There's one person that I interviewed who was kind of trying to move up to another position in management. And he was having a hard time because he couldn't, although he was very good at motivating the people on his team and his team did really well, his supervisors wanted him to be able to quantify that and to be able to say, exactly how he did that, how he was able to motivate people, like, and actually be able to measure that. And it was a moment where he realized, you know, that that's sort of what, you know, that's what it meant to be a manager, was that you had to kind of have metrics for how you were doing things. You know, and I think when it comes to, not necessarily managers, but in interacting with the white middle-class male trainers, you know, that I did interact with during the training, I think there, that sort of revealed really post-industrialism and capitalism, you know, at work, as everything I think in the book does, you know, and as these industries, you know, or as these jobs move from one population to another, and how kind of incomplete and problematic, those guys, how their frames of reference were for understanding some of the global dynamics. So, you could kind of see that they were on the ground figuring out and coming, realizing that, oh, wow, like I'm training, somebody that's going to replace me. And, you know, globalization is something that's hurting me too. And they were really rethinking, you know, what, like, their levels of education, for example. Many of those white trainers were not college educated, and they were clearly concerned about what was going to happen to them when, you know, their time at Elfin was over, and they had to, you know, return to the United States and potentially look for another job. So I think, you know, looking at managers and looking at folks in these sort of slightly higher level positions in the firm just gave me a different way of, you know, of seeing how these larger processes, you know, of post-industrialism or late capitalism really were working and reshaping people's lives and the way that they understood themselves and their futures and, you know, who they, you know, who they were.
So your last chapter examines how call center work has become associated with gender and sexual deviance, as well as with sexually transmitted disease. Here you describe how call centers have been constructed as queer sites through liberal hiring and promotion policies, the sexualization of global media, the sexual practices of youth, and as well as the industry's valorization of relational labor, which creates opportunities for bakla, trans women, and other queer peoples as performative individuals. Can you talk about this discourse around queerness and sexual practices that becomes attached to call center work?
Definitely. So the chapter you're referring to is chapter 5, and it's called Queering the Call Center, Sexual Politics, HIV/AIDS, and the Crisis of Reproduction. And I'll start by maybe just talking about the idea for this chapter and where it came from. So the idea for it came a little bit later in my research and my fieldwork. So it wasn't sort of like, you know, originally part of the dissertation proposal. But, you know, it came, these issues came to my attention because there were reports of rising HIV levels in the country around 2010. And other researchers who were looking into this traced a number of those new cases of HIV to call center workers. So in the sort of style of, you know, Stuart Hall and the British, you know, British cultural studies, I saw a moral panic really ensue in the wake of those reports. And what I argue is in the chapter is that the public was sort of primed for this moral panic because of the ways that the industry and workers and the whole sort of media assemblage, as you alluded to, were already marked as or framed as sexual and queer sites. So the chapter looks at a number of ways that this framework of the call center as a queer site or and a sexualized site was constructed. And I run through a number of different ways that, you know, this has happened prior to the reports of HIV cases running. So, you know, an example of that would be that a lot of people are they're obviously working at night, they're working overnight in order to, you know, meet the kind of demands of Western time zones. And so what this involves is, you know, a lot of young people circulating on the streets at night, working behind, you know, highly securitized spaces where it's not entirely clear, like, what, you know, what they're doing. And there's a sense that, you know, the kind of media, you know, kind of global media chains or connections that they're making open them up to or are making them part of sex work, or internet pornography and things like that. And so, and the kind of circulating at night opened up call centers to this impression that they were doing night work, which of course is, has a connotation of being, associated with sex commerce. So there were even kind of jokes about this early on in the call center that if you were a call center worker, you were a call boy or a call girl, which, is another way of saying that you're a sex worker. So there's already that kind of in place. And then at the same time, the industry became kind of known for being a place where, young people are forming intimate relationships with one another. And a lot of those intimate relationships really emerge because of the incredible amount of stress that workers are, undergoing, and also the kind of just camaraderie and general intimacy that they achieve as coworkers in this really unique environment. And I've talked to a number of workers who, who are under this impression about themselves as well, that, the call center is a place where you can find kind of casual sexual relationships, where also your own previous relationships, committed relationships might be challenged because, you don't see your partner at night if the partner doesn't work in the call center, and you're making all these new friends, in the industry, at work. At the same time, there's, these environments follow the non-discrimination policies of, that because these are usually American or European countries and they have non-discrimination policies. So they in hiring and promotion. So they are places where LGBTQ individuals can, find employment and, and kind of in some ways find a supportive environment amongst their peers in the workplace. So all of these factors together help to shape this discourse of the call center industry in the Philippines as a site where young people can identify as and express non-normative gender identities, non-normative sexual identities, and where they are forming these intimate relationships with one another that are read as deviant because they're not non-monogamous or they're casual or they're same-sex relationships, etc. And, all of this, as I described in the chapter, is happening against the backdrop of changing sexual politics in the country and, the passage of a historic reproductive rights bill in the country. So one of the things that I ultimately argue in the chapter is that the panic is not really about epidemiology or health per se, but it's a social and cultural panic about how these larger dynamics are playing out in the country. And it's, a fear about social reproduction, a fear that the industry itself, because of the kind of activities that people are, perceived to be going on in the industry will essentially be its own dead end, right? That the industry itself won't be able to reproduce the Philippines or workers because it is what one person described to me as like a sexual ticking time bomb. So I talk about how this kind of these ideas get wrapped up in the fear that of the larger, reproduction of the industry, that, it itself is a dead end, because, workers can't advance within it, because it's contingent on corporate, U.S. corporate capital. And I look at the way that young people working within the industry ultimately kind of come to stand in for these larger cultural crises. And really, as a result, their stigmatization is really amplified.
So, we've talked about a lot of your ideas in the book. And I'm curious what larger impact, you're hoping for the book to make on the different fields that you're, as an interdisciplinary scholar that you're kind of caught between, right? Labor studies, transnational Asian American studies is another field you mentioned. What are you seeing for the kind of future of this book?
I really hope that students and other scholars in those fields that you mentioned can take something away from the methodology and the analysis that the book engages in, how to look at something in everyday life that may seem not you know, may not seem super interesting or just has that kind of everyday quality and draw insights into larger processes. That's something that, as I was saying, you know, at the beginning of our discussion, that it was really important to me to do. And it's probably the reason I became an academic was that, you know, there are things in everyday life that we experience that are not spectacular things, right? Going to work often doesn't feel like a spectacular thing, but that, you know, are you know, sources of knowledge, and that critical thinking about those everyday things can really lead to kind of larger insights and understandings. Of course, I want folks in American studies and Asian American studies to think of this book as one that will help them think about the after effects of colonialism and how, you know, and how colonialism and colonial dynamics get recast in a marketplace, and how marketplace rhetoric, while seemingly neutral, and, you know, seemingly have nothing to do with identities or gender and, you know, race, ability, etc., that in fact are those are constitutive features of the way that markets are organized and economies are built and capitalism operates. For, you know, theories of labor, this is a really big one for me. I really hope that folks read the book and are motivated to think about the affective and emotional dimensions of the labor that people do. I think we're in this interesting moment where a lot of people are thinking about that, and, you know, we could be, you know, on the verge of a great re-theorizing of what effort, you know, it takes for human beings to you know, really support one another and also, you know, deal with difficult conditions, both just, you know, working conditions, but also living conditions, and the kinds of effort it now takes to just, you know, reproduce ourselves day in and day out. I think there's a lot to be said for that, that the book doesn't do. And I hope that, you know, people are inspired to look at those dynamics.
Thank you so much for joining us to talk about your book. Do you mind ending by sharing any new research that you've been working on? What comes next after this book?
Oh, sure. I'd love to. So I have a couple of different things, of course, and one of them is really one research avenue is picking up on ideas of media, technology, and emotions that come out of this book. It's not focused on the Philippines, but it is focusing on those ideas that don't really get super developed in the book. And so I'm looking at the way that media, technology, and emotions are intersecting through things like emotionally artificial intelligent machines or apps that help measure and regulate people's emotions. I wrote something recently that got published in Cultural Studies, an article called Mining the Mind, which is about how we live in an age in which how we feel, what we feel, and how our, you know, how our brains process emotions are increasingly important data for capital. I'm also returning to earlier work on the Philippine Carnival, which is a commercial industrial fair that took place during the American colonial era. That's actually, you know, based on the archival research I was doing in 2006, so a while ago. And that deals with the production of a Philippine colonial economy during the American colonial era and the forms of racial management that were inherent to that process. And then finally, I'm doing some personal writing, partly about growing up as a Filipino-American girl in suburban Florida and partly about traveling to the Philippines in the 20s and sort of what that meant for me and in my immediate family.
Wow, I want to read all that. That sounds amazing.
Thanks, Chris.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's my pleasure really to interview you for this book, and I really recommend the book to anyone, to the listeners out there who might be interested in any of the concepts about labor, about colonialism, and about the Philippines.
Great. The pleasure is all mine.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this interview with Jen Patios on her new book, A Nation on the Line, Call Centers as Postcolonial Predicaments in the Philippines. If you have any questions, grievances, or suggestions for books for this podcast, you can contact us on Facebook or Twitter. Thanks for listening.